This week on The Right Side, the BC Liberals oppose the rural attack of the NDP's electoral reform. Third-party foreign PACs could impact the next Alberta election. The media speculates on the Lac-Saint-Jean by-election and the American perception of NAFTA and their threat to pull out of the agreement. This is The Right Side, Episode 40, recorded Saturday, October 28th, 2017, the NAP PAC. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. Patrick and myself are back. Welcome back.
Good to be back, almost at the end of October, almost Halloween, and lots of things going on in Canada these days, eh?
Yeah, maybe scary, depending on your perspective. Hopefully this week's episode won't be too scary from the Halloween perspective, but Nonetheless, we are here to go through the news, put you on the right side of the news, remove bias and sensationalism, and hopefully provide a bit of context and clarity about what's been going on here.
Hopefully we can unmask some of the biases in journalists and in what's going on in politics these days.
Oh, definitely. And also unmask why the media isn't talking about some of the things that are really, really big issues, but, you know, they just seem to gloss over some of them. So that's what we're here to do. So we're going to begin in BC. So this is kind of a follow-up for us, but nonetheless, it's new news. So let's go.
Indeed. So 3 weeks ago, I talked about the BC NDP's plans to change the electoral system and that the referendum will be sent out about a year from now, and it requires 50% plus one vote to pass. I also talked about the biased media coverage at the time and how it didn't mention why the NDP and the Greens actually want electoral reform, because it will actually benefit both parties immensely. A pro-rep system would actually give a huge political advantage to smaller parties like the BC Green Party, who's conveniently supporting the NDP minority government and keeping them in power. And if the Greens significantly increase their number of MLAs, they could continue on a minority governing alliance with the New Democrats and freeze the BC Liberals out of power. And because of that, it appears that the supporters of the current first-past-the-post system have found a champion in the BC Liberals. So before I go on, I'll explain what first-past-the-post is. Essentially, under the current system, the province is divided into electoral districts of roughly the same population. Higher population urban centers will therefore be geographically smaller, and more rural areas will be much larger in size to compensate for the lower density. For example, roughly 90% of the province's geographic area outside the Lower Mainland and Victoria is represented by roughly 25% of the legislature's MLAs. However, under proportional representation, which is the system that the NDP government is favoring, the geographic area represented by an MLA will grow to accommodate for the other MLAs that are elected either through a party list, through direct elections by party percentage, or by another mean. It's still unclear as to which particular system the NDP favor to replace First Past the Post.
And that's a huge red flag for the media coverage thus far in this electoral reform issue, because there are so many different variants of proportional representation. It would have been nice to know out of the gate which one the NDP favored and which one they were going to be campaigning for.
Indeed. And it actually appears now that all of the BC Liberal leadership candidates are united in opposing the NDP Green idea to change the electoral system. Michael Lee says that, quote, "British Columbians have already twice rejected changes to our voting system, but the NDP and Greens won't take no for an answer. Proportional representation will lead to more minority coalition governments like the mess we have in Victoria right now. It will create uncertainty for investment community, negatively impact jobs and growth and our prosperity." And many BC MLAs from the rural areas of BC, including leadership candidate Todd Stone, were sharing a tweet from MLA John Rustad, who had a map of BC with the geographically small area of the Lower Mainland colored in orange. And the caption reads, "The population of the orange portion of this map is enough to change the voting system for all of BC." So it's clear from the tweet that it was an attempt to unite rural British Columbians against the potential tyranny of the majority. And it's also the reason why previous referendums on electoral reform were set at a 60% threshold to pass. Todd Stone is also... Exactly. And so Todd Stone has drawn attention to how the NDP's rules for the referendum would undercut the voting power of the North and the interior. He said, quote, "The NDP has unveiled a shocking attack on our democracy and on rural British Columbians. The NDP's plans mean that a small percentage of people, mainly in urban centers, will dictate the results for the entire province. Rural BC will be effectively shut out of the process and will lose its say. This is not fair." So an anonymous member that was mentioned in a Vancouver Sun article of the NDP government has suggested that adopting the mixed member proportional system, where MLAs would be partly elected from larger electoral districts and partly from party lists. He has suggested that for individual constituencies, the province would save time and effort by adopting the boundaries that were already in place to elect BC's 42-member complement in the federal parliament. And the remaining 45 provincial MLAs would be selected from the pool of the party list. Taking that scenario as an outcome, there would be a dramatic reduction in local representation, particularly in the regions, the rural regions that are being placed on alert by Stone and the other Liberals. So currently, the interior and the north are represented by 23 seats in the legislature. That's basically everywhere that's outside of the Lower Mainland and Vancouver Island. So that contingent would be reduced to just 10 if the New Democrats were to impose federal riding boundaries on the province. The entire northern half of BC, from Haida Gwaii to Pouce Coupe, and including much of Prince George, would actually be reduced from 7 seats to just 2. And the Okanagan and Kootenays, now with 11 seats, would drop to 5. The Cariboo-Thompson region would be reduced from 5 seats to 3. And other regions of the province would lose local representation as well, of course. But the New Democrats and the Green Partners could be readily be accused of not minding the reduction in local representation in the north and the interior, given that they only hold 4 out of the 23 seats there in the first place.
There are so many red flags regarding the process, from the voting percentage to the type of proportional representation that's being talked about, to the fact that, you know, just your number here, the reduction in seats from 23 down to just 10, that is very undemocratic. And it's a wonder why this isn't a larger issue in the media.
Mm-hmm. And you have to think, the BC Liberals have actually carried the popular vote in the last few elections, so they would still benefit from this system as well, being the most popular party in the province. However, it would cause a lot of minority situations, and in this case, there would be a lot of local representation that's being lost, which for a rural MP or a rural MLA is actually quite important, because you have such a large area to cover to begin with. If you have a much larger area to go for, that raises a lot of like transportation issues, being able to talk to your local MLA,
right,
and a lot of other issues regarding that as well.
You know, those issues are talked about in Alberta too, but the vast majority of Alberta, aside from the western portion of it, is flat, whereas the terrain of BC is much different. So, you know, you get the idea of how difficult this would make things.
And geographically, BC is a bigger province than Alberta as well, and it's a lot harder to get to some areas of the province as well. Highways are a lot more winding than it is in Alberta, where you can basically drive in a straight line in any direction to each city and major center, right?
Yeah.
I think the only exception to that is probably heading out towards the western areas, where there's only few certain highways out that way. Whereas BC, we only have a few main highways to choose from, especially once you get north of Prince George. So it's actually quite a bit more difficult to get to some of the more rural regions. And that's going to cause a lot of problems for representation.
Right. And, you know, I think a good way of looking at this would be to flip the flip the discussion around and say, what if there was a government in power that was suggesting that power be limited in such a way by half to, you know, however many seats are currently in Vancouver Island and the Lower Mainland, and reduce that number by half and redistribute that through the rest of the province. Flip the argument around and you see what an absurdity this is, and, you know, you got to ask why this isn't being covered more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's something that it's mentioned a couple times in the media, but not very much, and especially not in the local Vancouver and Victoria papers. It's certainly held in the more provincial papers, but not in the more local ones that people are going to read more often, especially in the bigger population centers. And this is actually a big thing for people that live on Vancouver Island as well, because our seats would also be reduced, as well as Vancouver. I mean, it would all be reduced, and it then would be up to the parties to decide who they want their MLAs to be under the party list system. And that's leaving the hands of who it becomes an MLA into the hands of the parties themselves, rather than up to the people who would directly elect them, the voters.
Which, once again, seems undemocratic. And
indeed.
A little bit hypocritical to be having a suggestion like this floated by a government that calls themselves the New Democratic Party of British Columbia. So,
indeed.
All right. Well, we're going to move over to Alberta right now. We're going to continue talking about electoral systems, except this time the headline is that Chief Electoral Officer warns of dangers of third-party activities in next Alberta election. So Alberta's Chief Electoral Officer sounded a warning that activities by third-party organizations could skirt provincial law and, quote, create an uneven playing field in the next provincial election. And the next provincial election is, of course, slated for 2019. So looking back to the last federal election, we saw the highest number of third parties ever registered to campaign an election. The good majority of these were targeted against the incumbent Harper government. The activities of these third parties is what led Prime Minister Stephen Harper to begin our longest campaign ever. When the campaign started, he stated, "Everyone is campaigning, everybody should finance their own campaign, and everybody should operate under the law and the rules for campaigns." And of course, this was because there was a lot of third-party advertising and third-party campaigning that was going on in the spring and summer leading up to the election. So the idea behind this was, if we call the election early, you can have the entirety of the election for the political parties and the third parties carried out under Canada's Election Act. So now, looking forward to the 2019 race in Alberta, we see that similar issues have already been identified. As of right now, there are 10 third-party political advertisers registered with Elections Alberta. The article from the Calgary Herald here also highlights that the three who are running for the current leadership of the United Conservative Party, which we'll have coverage of on next week's episode of The Right Side, all started their own PACs, P-A-C-S, which is short for Political Action Committees. One of the NDP government's first bills here was for campaign finance reform, and that included new rules for third-party advertisers, requiring them to disclose on a quarterly basis their donations that are used for advertising, as well as expenditures on advertising. The NDP also took action and banned corporate and union donations, which is, of course, something that was an issue in the BC election here. Mm-hmm. The issue that arises from this is that these PACs can currently be funded by anyone, any corporation, any union, or any group in Alberta. These PACs can then advertise at will for or against whatever candidate they see fit. Elections Alberta wants the province to amend the rules so that advertising rules will correct this issue. Elections Alberta also highlights that Alberta is the only province that extends the exemption from restrictions on non-commercial advertising online to corporations and groups. So basically what this means is that, you know, we have legislation for advertising on TV, on radio, and in the newspaper, but there are practically no rules for corporations or unions or groups online advertising. And, you know, with online advertising, Facebook, Twitter, and the micro-targeting that can happen with those platforms, it's a pretty big issue going into 2019, as we saw in the U.S. election. So The chief electoral officer would also like the province to introduce a pre-writ period that would allow for increased regulation of third parties in the month prior to an election call. The Minister for Democratic Renewal, Christina Gray, said back in July that she would consider further legislative changes because there is a perception that groups are being formed to avoid existing rules. She further backed this up this past Thursday and said that the government will consider all of Elections Alberta's recommendations on the matter at hand here. So as you can see, we're still about 2 years away from the next provincial election here, but people have already taken note of what's happening with the political action committees and advertising groups here in Alberta and are wanting to ensure that those groups will not have a, let's just say, an uneven sway in the race.
Yeah, and that's something that did occur here in BC, where a lot of pro-business groups were fundraising heavily for the BC Liberals, whereas on the flip side, a lot of pro-union groups and worker-related groups were donating heavily to the NDP. So both of the major parties here were benefiting from it, and the ones that weren't, of course, benefiting from it were the smaller parties, but also the voters that had a bit of a less of a say in government because government was taking a lot of their cues from the huge groups that were donating to them.
Right.
So something that was very important and that was missed by the BC Liberals in the last election here was there was a huge movement to ban corporate and union donations. And that's something that's going to be happening here. But of course, there's a way to do that. And as you might remember, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about this in BC, how it's going to be a direct voter subsidy instead of the corporate and union donations. So now taxpayers are directly funding government, which is also something that's not good. So
yeah, it's a bit of a head scratcher.
Indeed. So we'll have to see what happens here in Alberta to fix their problems.
Right.
But what do you see as the best course of action for them to do?
Well, see, the problem with this is that, you know, you can set up a PAC or political action committee, and you can effectively skirt the rules that are right here, right now, in terms of the corporate and union donations, which, you know, people might be happy about. But if they can do this, you have to ask, what is the point of limiting these limiting corporate and union donations if they can just be skated around? And I just have to point back to the last federal election, because you know, the 2008 race and the 2011 race went off fairly well in terms of not being influenced too much by third party money. But it seems as though that in the 2015 race there was a huge push by lots and lots of third parties to donate, and like I said, most of them seem to be donating against the incumbent Conservative government. And with that being said, you got to wonder if maybe we need some kind of legislation Canada-wide that effectively will shut down these political action committees, because that's the same problem that the U.S. has. Granted, we're not to the same level of the U.S., but in the U.S., anyone can form a political action committee, and they funnel millions and millions of dollars to candidates, and that's how you end up with these candidates that won't do anything that will upset their huge funders. And we don't want to head down that road here in Canada, so perhaps it's something to look at nationwide, and the provinces should also look at as well on their books. Because, you know, if you're going to be able to skirt the issue, it's like having no rules whatsoever. So the rules we have are effectively a waste of time until these political action committees can be reined in. And another thing with this, there are only 10 right now in Alberta, but depending on how this race starts to shape up in the remaining 18 months or so before the actual election call, you could see more political action committees form either on the Conservative side or on the NDP side to prop up the NDP in Edmonton and Calgary. So we'll just have to see what the tides of waters looks like and see if the NDP government wants to put these restrictions in or if they think they can benefit by leaving them out. And another issue we haven't touched on when it comes to PACs is that they, in large part, can take money from foreign donors. the money can be funneled to a Canadian organization, and then that Canadian organization can give it to the PAC, and then that PAC can do their own advertising. So it's a multi-chained level, whereas, you know, we're not getting funded, for example, by some group out of San Francisco, but that group out of San Francisco, say, funds another group out of Vancouver, and that group in Vancouver funds a PAC in Alberta to attack or support one political party. So that's another thing that also needs to be looked at with these, and why they should probably just be eliminated entirely in Canada.
Yeah, and I think something that we really pride on in Canada is that we're very, very much rely on our politics and our elections to occur just within Canada, and that there's a limiting factor on foreign influence in our elections here.
Definitely.
Which was certainly a very, very big concern in the last American election. And for elections worldwide as well, there's always a bit of a concern.
Yeah.
And I think elections in Canada, they're generally fair, free, and open in how they're conducted and without foreign influence, and something that Canadians pride themselves on. And I think having these unlimited restrictions on PACs is something that would damage democracy in Canada, and it would cause a lot of foreign influence and money to enter Canada on one side or another, and that's something that really shouldn't happen.
Oh yeah, I mean, just look back to the 2015 race, and there were thought to be links between San Francisco-based environmental groups funding other groups in Canada that were raising money with PACs and supporting one side or the other. So it's a definite issue. And there's also the issue of needing to look at online advertising as well, because someone in a different country can purchase an advertisement on Twitter or Facebook and have it targeted towards people in Canada. So lots of issues to deal with before 2019, and we'll have to see if we have the apparatus to fix it. All right. What do we got for Canada this week?
All right. So for Canada, back on the 23rd of October, we had a by-election, a couple of by-elections here. And way back on episode 32, 2 months ago, I talked about the federal by-election that was occurring in the riding of Lac St. John to replace the retired popular conservative MP Denis Lebel, and how it would be a test as to how each political party was doing. And as well, it would be a major test for the new conservative leader Andrew Scheer to hold on to the riding, and for the new NDP leader Jagmeet Singh to make headway in Quebec, where NDP support has been slipping since 2011. Located northeast of Quebec City, the largely francophone riding of Lac St. John has traditionally been blue, either of the conservative or of the Bloc Québécois. Since 1984, the riding, which has seen its boundaries grow over time, has voted twice for Brian Mulroney's conservatives, five times for the Bloc Québécois, and then four times for Stephen Harper's conservatives. So I also mentioned how Trudeau was very visible in the riding, and how the federal government promised millions for the riding's constituents to improve technological infrastructure such as cell phone coverage as well as internet service. And it was a big gamble for the Liberals, as it gave the impression that the government was using tax dollars to buy off the riding. So fast forward back over to October 23rd, and Liberal candidate Richard Hebert pulled ahead of the Bloc Québécois and the Conservative candidates to win the riding of Lac St. John with just 38.6% of the vote. And the Conservatives ended up with 25%, and the Bloc Québécois, who were leading for the first half of the night, ended up in third with 23.4%. The NDP candidate finished in fourth at a distant 11.7%. And in the 2015 election, you might remember that the NDP were in second, just behind the Conservatives. The other by-election that was held was in Sturgeon River Parkland, which covers the outskirts of Edmonton to the west and north, as well as the towns of Spruce Grove and Stony Plain. Dane Lloyd of the Conservatives handily won with a staggering 77.4% of the vote. However, the media barely mentioned the Sturgeon River Parkland result and mainly focused their attention on Lac St. John. They pounced on the Lac St. John election results and were competing with each other to get the best headlines. The Globe and Mail, for example, wrote, quote, "By-election upset victory fuels liberal hopes in Quebec," with the tagline, The Liberals surged, the Conservatives sagged, and the NDP crashed. In the same article, the Sturgeon River Parkland result was briefly noted in two sentences in the very last paragraph. So the media has mentioned that the Lac St. John result was a blow to Andrew Scheer, but in the grand scheme of things, it really wasn't. The main test for the Conservatives, of course, will be in the next election in 2019. The party leader that should be the most concerned is probably Jagmeet Singh. His candidate's dismal fourth place showing after coming in second in 2015 should be concerning and may be indicative of Singh's plummeting popular support in Quebec. And the only reason for the Conservatives to be concerned is that reduced support for the NDP may actually mean increased support for the Liberals. So said Carl Bellanger, who is a political analyst who is a former senior NDP official, this was a bad night for the NDP. The results illustrate the challenges ahead for Mr. Singh and the 16 NDP MPs in Quebec when it comes to keeping their beachhead in the province. Said Conservative MP Gerard Deltel, he said, quote, "This is not the result we hope for, obviously, but let's be clear, the people of Lac St. John decided to send an MP to Ottawa who would sit on the government's bench. They voted for power, but in the next general election in 2 years' time, it will be an entirely different story." So for the Bloc, even though it finished in third place, the Bloc touted the fact that its score had gone up 5 points in the riding since the last election. Said Bloc MP Rael Fortin, quote, "I have no doubt that in 2019 we can win that riding. Justin Trudeau's honeymoon period is coming to an end."
It's very interesting that this is a huge issue. One, it is a rural riding in Quebec. Secondly, voter turnout in both of these races was in the 20% range, give or take. And that is not an accurate representation of the voter base as it is right now. You need the entire voter base to come together to get a true representation of what's going on. I think we've seen by-elections in the past where they've gone for one party in midterm and then switched a couple years later in the next election. So that is entirely possible here as well, either way.
Yeah, you can remember back in the Toronto Danforth riding back when Jack Layton passed away, they voted for the NDP candidate Craig Scott in the by-election that was held, I believe, in 2013. And then in the 2015 election, the Liberals ended up winning it. So that was the case there. So in the Sturgeon River Parkland, the voter turnout was closer to 23%, whereas in the Quebec riding, it was actually higher than 35%. So it was a little bit higher, but still not on the level as what would be in a federal election.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe just playing a bit of benefit of the doubt here for the media, but perhaps a reason why they didn't mention the Sturgeon River Parkland result is because that's expected. But I mean, 77% is still a huge margin for any party, and maybe that says stuff for the Liberals and NDP here in Alberta on aggregate, perhaps. So, mm-hmm. Four Liberal seats in Alberta, two of them in Calgary, which hasn't happened in the 60s. So this could indeed be a signal for that as well. If we were wanting to write some similar articles, except focusing on the Alberta result instead, that is probably the headline that people could go with for that. So, it certainly is also a very interesting result, because when the results first came in, the Bloc Québécois was very far ahead in the results, but just continued to drop all the way through. So I'm just guessing that's based on where the vote count started, if anyone observing was wondering about that.
Indeed. And it's something that's very interesting, is that a lot of the articles were talking about how this was a great result for Trudeau and how it forecasts his stronger support in the region. But really, the next election doesn't happen for another 2 years, give or take. And a lot can happen in that time, and anything can happen and change, in especially a province that has as volatile a political record as Quebec. I mean, when you have that extra party that does really well in the Bloc Québécois, that adds a lot of volatility to a lot of the results that will happen in Quebec. And a lot of MPs can be won can win through really low support levels, like this one here. He won with a staggering amount, but it was only 38.6% of the vote. So a lot can happen, and I think things will change definitely before 2019. We'll have to see what happens with the NDP there and how their support ends up helping the Liberals, or if something else will happen. So it'll be something that we'll have to follow up on again.
Yeah, and 2 years is a really long time for a staggering result like this, as the media called it. So a bit of I don't know if we'd call that grandstanding, but 38.6% is not colossal or outstanding. So, All right. So our next segment is the firing line. And this week we got for our headline, "Napping on NAFTA, Harper blasts Trudeau government for its handling of negotiations." So this was an article in the CBC, and it was put together by a memo that was obtained by the Canadian Press. And according to all of our news sources here in Canada and the Canadian Press, the title of this memo is "Napping on NAFTA." According to the press here, Stephen Harper sent this to folks at his firm, Harper and Associates, and it is a criticism of the current ongoing process of the NAFTA negotiations that are going on with the U.S. and Mexico. So recall that we've talked about NAFTA a number of times here on the Right Side, episodes 31 and 33, just to give a bit of a background. And most of the things that we talked about have actually been mentioned here in this piece. So first and foremost here, quoting from the article, it criticizes the Trudeau government in several areas. One, for too quickly rejecting U.S. proposals. Second, for insisting on negotiating alongside Mexico. And three, for promoting progressive policies like labor, gender, Aboriginal, and environmental issues. Boy, where have we heard that before?
almost on every other episode of The Right Side where we talk about NAFTA, it seems.
That's right. So going through this, one of the focuses on the U.S. proposals that is criticized is that the government feels as though the red lines that the U.S. administration is laying down is not necessarily true. But Harper and Associates feel that this is an actual red line and that the Canadian negotiation contingent should take this very seriously and that this is not a bluff by the Americans. In here it says, "I fear that the NAFTA negotiation is going very badly. I also believe that President Donald Trump's threat to terminate NAFTA is not a bluff. I believe this threat is real." And, you know, that makes sense because if you're not going to get a deal on NAFTA and you're not going to be able to come out with a better deal than the U.S. currently has with NAFTA, they're gonna focus elsewhere because they probably feel that they could get a better bilateral deal with Canada and Mexico individually than they can in this threesome agreement with Canada, U.S., and Mexico. So that is indeed something that is true here. So that's point number one. The second point is regards to Canada standing with Mexico in terms of negotiation. So in effect, you have Canada and Mexico negotiating together against the U.S. versus instead of negotiating what is best for Canada. And we've talked about this before as well. Our issues that we deal with in NAFTA are going to be completely different than the issues that the Mexicans deal with in NAFTA. For instance, we don't have a very low-cost labor force that needs to be negotiated into NAFTA. On the other hand, we have natural resources. We have manufacturing. We have dairy that can be potential issues. So those are issues where Canada, on their own, needs to be standing together against the U.S. and Mexico because, like it or not, those are issues that the U.S. and Mexico don't have when it comes to the NAFTA negotiation table. Because last I checked, Canada is the only country with supply management in the NAFTA agreement, which is basically the government oversight of our dairy sector that makes it very hard for the Americans to compete when they want to buy dairy products from Canada. And we talked about this before with Wisconsin having problems buying raw dairy products from Quebec. And that became a sticking point with NAFTA.
And also causes problems where Canadians are having trouble buying American products in Canada as well. And it's creating basically a monopoly for the Canadian producers, which is good for those Canadian producers who then don't really have much competition when it comes to buying their goods. But it also doesn't really help consumers who
exactly.
are wanting to have more choice and who are also wanting to have lower prices from the increased competition, which I think is another issue.
You hit the nail right on the head, because if you look at the price of a gallon of milk up in Nunavut or even remote Ontario, remote Quebec, you're looking anywhere between $6 and $9 for that gallon of milk, which is outright criminal considering it is produced in Canada. It should not be that expensive. So that is supply management in a nutshell. And then we come to progressive priorities, which we talked about on episodes 31 and 33 of The Right Side. And you have to look at the Trump administration. The Trump administration is not going to care about policies like gender, Aboriginal, and environmental issues when it comes to a trade deal. Trade, in a nutshell, for the current U.S. administration, focuses in on getting the best price for the American goods that they are selling. We need to be focused in on the same thing, getting the best price for our Canadian goods and what we're selling to the U.S. and Mexico. And as a result of that, the progressive priorities that have been outlined by Chrystia Freeland and Catherine McKenna on the environment file really aren't going to garner much sway when it comes to NAFTA negotiations. So it's not just us now at The Right Side saying it, but also it has been highlighted in this memo. And you also have to look at what the media coverage says when Trudeau goes to see Trump. When was the last time we saw a Canadian leader at one point described as meek and then awkward in the presence of a U.S. president?
Certainly didn't happen under Harper, and it definitely didn't happen under Paul Martin and John Chrétien. And before that, I don't really recall hearing that much about them being as young as we were back then. But I mean, this has been the first time in a while where the American media has really not been too fond of the Canadian Prime Minister, which is very interesting to see, because normally they get along with them very well because of their more liberal tendencies. And it's interesting to see that's how they portrayed Trudeau.
And this all plays into the negotiation factors of NAFTA. There's also issues like softwood lumber. We have a softwood lumber issue with the U.S., and we have for a number of years since 2015 when the last deal expired. Solving softwood lumber forever would be a good thing to get into NAFTA, but are we talking about that? No. Another thing that we are putting ourselves at risk by of not negotiating from an upright position on NAFTA is increased tariffs on Bombardier and getting those jets to the U.S. So there are just tons and tons of issues here that are constantly being overlooked by the government, and we're not seeing an honest criticism of it in media, even when a memo from former Prime Minister Stephen Harper gets reported on. The government's response was, "We don't agree with former PM Harper's advice. We will continue to defend Canadian interest. Capitulation is not a negotiating strategy." That was Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland describing Harper's position as capitulation.
Which I don't think is very genuine either, because taking the threats of the Americans seriously is not what I would consider capitulation or giving in to them. I think that just means
they're
that
our number one ally.
Yeah, I think it just means that you're being real about where the American government stands on the issues and are able to negotiate according to that and be able to get what the best interest is for Canada. Now, Chrystia Freeland, of course, calls that capitulation because she wants to make it seem like Harper's advice is to give up and just give the Americans what they want. But that's not the case at all in what Harper has been saying.
Indeed. And also with this, former Conservative cabinet member Lisa Rayton, now Conservative Party deputy leader, said that in this case, Stephen Harper was just putting his thoughts down on paper and that, quote, a lot of people agree with him. And she also said, I think it's a very valid point for him to do that. So, and there was also a little very interesting quote at the end of the CBC article. An anonymous Canadian official said, it's a bit sad that this kind of thing was happening, this kind of memo from Stephen Harper. And I mean, it's an anonymous official, and sometimes the media needs to do anonymous reporting like this. But I think if we've proven anything in the last year, it's that anonymous sources can't always be trusted in the mainstream media. So that was an interesting little nugget that CBC decided to throw in at the end of their piece. So,
yeah, especially when he then goes on, this anonymous official then goes on to say, he's basically saying we need to make more concessions to the Americans, turn our backs on workers, turn our backs on softwood lumber workers, blah, 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 blah. And it's talking about
all the stuff. We don't know who said that. It could be made up.
Exactly. That could be a liberal MP. Who knows? I mean,
Gerald Butts.
It doesn't even mean that Harper wasn't saying anything about giving more concessions. He's just saying that threat around President Trump's threat to terminate NAFTA is real, and that it doesn't matter whether the current American proposals are worse than what we have now. What matters is evaluating whether it's worth having a trade agreement with the Americans or not.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what he said, and he's saying that we need to take them seriously. And he's not saying that we need to capitulate, like Freeland says, and he's definitely not saying that we need to make more concessions to them. We just have to say that we have to approach the trade negotiation as a realist, and as realists, and realize that certain things are important to Canadians and the Canadian government, but they're not going to be important to the Americans.
Exactly.
And
mm-hmm. The government needs to see that, and if not, we could end up with NAFTA being torn up. So, all right. So that pretty much wraps up our content for the week. What do we got for Word of the Week this week?
So Word of the Week this week is going to be a PAC, which is the Political Action Committee, which you talked about in your Alberta article. Now, political action committees are a type of organization that pools campaign contributions from members and donates those funds to campaigns for or against candidates, ballot initiatives, or legislation. So where you see this a lot is in the United States, where candidates themselves will actually form PACs and what they call super PACs or super PACs to be able to fundraise more heavily and be able to get around campaign finance rules and basically to be able to raise more money than their opponents.
And that has led to one of the biggest issues in American elections in a long time is practically the unlimited cash flow of money. And, you know, you might not think we have that issue in Canada, but it does exist. It happened in the 2015 race. Alberta has drawn attention to it. You guys are looking at finance reform in BC, and everyone needs to ask a question of themselves and their representatives is, do we want to go down the path of having practically unlimited money flowing into these races through PACs and super PACs? And I think the answer to that is no. And that's why Alberta has raised that issue, and hopefully we'll see something done about it by the 2019 race. All right. So I think that's it for this episode of The Right Side. Anything else to add before we go?
I believe that's all.
Okie dokie. So we can find full show notes at rightsidenews.ca. We're also on Twitter and Facebook at RightsideCA. If you want to subscribe to us on iTunes or YouTube, you can find that at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes or /YouTube. We'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.
And we will continue to give you the right side of the news, highlighting the bias and complicit agreement of the mainstream media to not give us the right side of the news. But we will always give that to you here. So with that, we will see you next week.